this is the part where I tell you how you can support the show. Head on over to freemanbeyondthewall.com/support. There are many ways there that you can support the show. The best way is on that website. If you go right to the store, you can do that annually or monthly, or you can just send something in the mail. It's P.O. Box 413, Lineville, Alabama, 36266. I always enjoy reading the letters. They really mean a lot to me, and I save every single one of them, and I try to respond in some way to each and every one. So I just want to thank everybody for making it possible for me to do this. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I want to welcome everyone back to the Piquinones Show. Samuel Urban is here for the first time. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm great. How are you doing, Pete?
Good. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm my name's Samuel Urban. I mainly do the Illegitimate Scholar podcast, and that's a cultural anthropology podcast that's against academia, not against academia, but you know, an alternative to academia. I was in school to be a history teacher when I was in college. Well, actually, I had to start a little bit before then. I was in the Marine Corps, got out of the Marine Corps to go to college to be a history teacher. I love the content, but I didn't like how a number of things, both with how the limitations on what was allowed to be talked about, the frameworks in public schools, government schools especially. So I got certified and I got degrees in history and anthropology and education, but I quit my master's degree and I started the podcast. And that's what I'm doing now. And I'm doing a number of other things at the moment, but the main thing is Illegitimate Scholar.
So, I mean, how much have you done any teaching, classroom teachings?
So just my, I've taught a full load as a student teacher, which is like a requirement to get certified. I taught civics, 10th grade civics, world history, and U.S. history. Yeah, so there's one civics, one U.S. history, and one world history.
Yeah. Well, I have enough shows where I mention, you know, this thing called wokeism that's taken the name wokeism and rail against it, make fun of it, just do as much as you can to just make try to make it seem like the joke that it is. Now, it's not a joke when people like that have power or they have the power of the state behind them, but you know, the more you can just, you know, make fun of them, and I'm just totally missing a word of what word am I thinking of?
To disparage just,
disparage them, but also discredit them.
Discredit them,
as much as you can to discredit them. But there is, I understand there are historical arguments for why it exists, that it exists, and that it is in fact a religion. So that was the point of one of your podcasts recently, that as far as anthropology goes, it would be considered a religion. But can you talk a little bit about how these things evolve?
So can you be more specific on these things,
like
wokeism in general?
How wokeism would evolve, how, like, you know, you could look at the peace, love, hippie movement of the 60s. Right. And a lot of people will just tell you, you know, that was CIA. But I don't think the CIA created it out of thin air. There had to be something there for it to grab onto. So,
right. So I think that the path to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think that essentially the grassroots level of wokeism is a bunch of well-meaning people who legitimately believe that racism is a scourge on America, which, you know, there's real problems with racism, and then there's real effects of that, but it's latching on to it as like the main issue. And then beyond that, the most important thing is institutionalizing the perception of what racism is, what, you know, trans genocide is, these definitions. It's such a broad question that it's tough to answer without talking for a really long time, but it's, there's something natural. There's a certain feeling that people have, and then that feeling is taken, and the definitions of words are warped, and they're changed, and they're by people who have different intentions, people who have, you know, ulterior motives, and they frame them to be what they want them to be. And in a lot of cases, that is like to retain power and authority in where they want it to be, and to give power and authority to the patrons of who they are. And when I say they, I'll be more specific and give an example here. It's the practical effect of what you would call wokeism, this concentration on racism. What ends up happening is that it's particular areas of discrimination and particular ways of defining race and discrimination that get the attention. So, for example, you have a situation where people want to attack racism. They want to solve issues of racism. So they boil everything down to the color of people's skin. And then what you have is disproportionately people who are of African or West Indian descent who are Black going to elite universities, whereas actual African American who descended from freed American slaves, they're not as high of a percentage of the population. And what I think the effect of this is a multicultural, it's a multicultural elite that has taken over the U.S. under the guise of immigrants and all these different groups of people being discriminated against, while the U.S. doesn't recognize things like caste discrimination as real discrimination. So like an immigrant from India is just, even though they're a Brahmin, they're a member of the elite, they come to the United States and they are viewed as someone who's discriminated against simply because they're an immigrant, and the other factors are important. And I know I said a lot there, so whatever you want to latch on to.
Okay, well, I wanted to latch on to the fact that you said that there are real effects of racism in society. I went over the term racism is older than Magnus Hirschfeld, but he's really the one who cemented it into, you know, brought it in. Frankfurt School picked up on it and just ran with it. What do you see as the, if you believe there are real effects of racism that's happening, that these people are latching on to? I mean, what are the real effects of racism? Because, I mean, to me, there might be racism, but like, I think everyone is pretty much racist, and I don't think right. That's a bad thing. I don't see it as a negative.
No, right. So exactly. There's, you know, the same action that is taken by like an action or something said by a white person will be viewed completely differently than when it's said by someone like Ibram X. Kendi or Kenneth Rogers, whatever his original name was before he, you know, Africanized himself more. So when I say there's real effects of racism, I guess I should rephrase that to say that there was, you know, there was historic discrimination. I'm not making a value judgment on racism, good or bad, but of course, in the past, there was situations where Black people were kept out of certain things in America. And I think that people assume, and there's a direct quote from Ibram X. Kendi that I talk about in here. And I'd have to find it specifically, but he says something along the lines of we have a hard time understanding that racism is the sole cause of racial disparities in America. And that's kind of what I was talking about with how, like, and that's not true. I mean, and that's not true. And when you make a claim like that, you leave no room for discussion. You leave no room for nuance. It's just racism is the sole cause of racial disparities. Anything else is, you know, a fascist talking point, whatever buzzword is there at the time. And that is, you know, we'll go into more specifics of this, but that's a religious devotion to that idea. So when I'm talking about like there are real effects of racism, I mean, you know, redlining, white flight, whatever. But of course, those are also things where they don't go into maybe the specifics of why. I think you recently were talking about a book, from the 60s or 70s about like
race war in high school.
The high school, right. And it's like, you know, okay, white flight happened. Maybe that's racism, or maybe they were fleeing crime, essentially. So, yeah, there's no value judgment for me there, but in the past, there definitely was a time when Black people did have negatives based on the color of their skin, whereas today it's kind of the opposite. You have benefits for the color of your skin, but the perception is that there's racism,
right?
Negatively.
Yeah, I mean, well, and the argument could be made that, well, there were reasons why Blacks were precluded from some things,
and yeah. Abraham Lincoln himself would give you those arguments.
Yeah, so. Yeah, when it comes down to it, what I see is progressivism at its core believes in tabula rasa, clean slate. And so you're born a clean slate, and everything that you learn from your environment. And if they can just from birth engineer and, you know, anti-fascist, anti-racist babies, then you will have a perfect world. Now, I believe there are some people who believe that. That actually honestly believe that. I believe there's no way I believe that Ibram X, whatever his name is, believes that. You know, they're in it for the grift. I hate that term, because that's another term that's been used to the point where people who use it don't even know what it means. But BLM, you have the founders of BLM buying multiple houses. You have all these people who basically took over what some would term, not me, good causes, but yet they steer the cause to benefit them. Their true believer who's following them just never sees any kind of progress, quote unquote. I mean,
right.
It's not progressive. There's no progress in their work. And when they go to the leadership, the leadership just says, well, I mean, there's still racism. So everything is, it's a circle where everything comes back, and you have a bunch of people on top, a couple of people on top who are pushing something that's impossible, that will never be achieved. Yet they have a whole bunch of people following them that are disappointed when it doesn't materialize. And then when it doesn't materialize, it's very rare that Black people are going to blame other Black people.
Right.
You know, that Hispanics are going to blame other Hispanics. You know, so
right.
I could use the example.
Black on Asian crime is white people's fault. Right.
Right. I mean, everything is the fault of racism is the easiest thing to pin everything on. So that becomes the sacrament, you know, and it's like, it's like in Jewish supremacy, everything comes back to the Holocaust. And you start from there. It's like the cross. It's like their crucifixion. Everything starts at their cross. And then everything forward is them, being the eternal victim and having to basically get away with anything they want and exercise power in ways that are damaging to everybody, most of the people who are non-Jews. And then you see the same, you can look over and you can realize maybe somebody learned from somebody here, because that's the exact same thing that the anti-racist people do.
Right. So there's this gets down to the point of like foundational beliefs. And this is why so many times there's ideological things like this targeted as children, because if you can get to the point where it is religious, and in this sense, when I'm saying religious, it's down to the foundation. So it's your base beliefs. And often these end up being tied to your identity. When a belief is tied to your identity, you consider it much more important, and you consider attacks on those beliefs to be attacks on your identity. And that's at least what a portion of the issues that we have in our country today are due to, I think. And so when I think about wokeism, when I think about what this thing is, I really do view it at a religious level. And it gets to the point. So I live in New England, and so I live around a lot of people like this. And New England has its roots in a puritanical society. It was the most religious society, religiosity meaning like the amount of zealousness that people had for their religion, as well as like the percentage of people that were was at the highest ever. I mean, they left Europe and came here because they were so religious. And I fully believe in this is an idea that it's in American Nations and in Albion Seed, that the foundational root of a place like that is pervasive through even new immigration. So when I look at a place like New England, which is really like the root of education in the United States, as well as the root of this puritanical culture, what I really see in the people that I interact with is a devotion to wokeism that is really with that puritanical spirit. And it's even more dangerous because it's not recognized actively as being puritanical and as being religious. But, you know, talking to some of the people that I talk to every day, well, I avoid people like this, even though I live in New England, but a conversation with them will be, it'll end up being that, like, they're not, they instinctively and aggressively, and, you know, their instinct is that any number of my beliefs are just inherently wrong because they have these foundational beliefs that they view as superior and as foundational to their beliefs, and that any deviation from them is insane. Like, I was speaking to a social worker recently, unfortunately. It's something I like to avoid all the time, but not for anything like work related, but just having a conversation with them. And she started, you know, kind of talking down to me about how about how giving kids puberty blockers is the best thing, and that it stops suicide. And, you know, she was talking to me like she was teaching me about it. And like, I don't know how she didn't, like, she knows what I do. She knows like what I talk about. I don't know how she thought that she was telling me information I didn't know, but that's, it was very odd, but that's the type of foundational belief it is. It's that they believe that they're so, that the belief is such a truth. It's an eternal truth, similar to that in a religion. And at the point when it's not understood to be that, it is extraordinarily dangerous. But this is also, and I'm sorry, I'm being long-winded, but this is sort of the natural state of religion in most places. And one of the things I talked about is the compartmentalization of religion and the compartmentalization of life. Whereas prior to about the Protestant Revolution, and I'm sure you and I could talk about Protestantism all day, but religion in most parts of the world and in Europe prior to the Protestant Revolution, it's assumed to be in ultimate and eternal truth. It's not assumed to be something that is to be argued about. It's assumed to be the baseline. And that really is the devotion to wokeism that these people have. But it's this older style where they're not recognizing it as such. Okay, I hope I made sense there.
Well, yeah, as it grows, you see like a movement where, you know, I'm old enough to remember when people, like, the first time I heard the term political correctness, that was a long time ago. And you're just like, from somebody who grew up in New York City, you're just like, we say whatever we want. And if we get out of line, we might get smacked. You know, and it seems like that's like history. That's humanity. And that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. But we're also getting to the point in this civilization, quote unquote, where enough riches, enough wealth has been spread around, and people have seen enough wealth, and with technology, that people have reached a point where they believe that because we have all these things, perfection is right around the corner. And mm-hmm. I think that's a big problem. You know, that was a problem that, you know, a lot of Protestants were like, would listen to John Wesley talk about how he thought that people could be perfect and sinless in this lifetime. And everybody was like, what are you even talking about, dude? And
yeah.
I mean, it does come back to, like, if you're going to have an anti-racist baby, to quote one of their, yeah, I think that's the title of one of their books. You have to have a faith that goes beyond reason, yet they're not willing to, these are all materialists. They don't believe in the metaphysical. And if they do believe it, and the ones that do believe in the metaphysical, I mean, they're even friggin' worse. I mean, they're dangerous because they believe they have God. They believe they have God on their side.
Right, right. It is. I'm not familiar. I couldn't even think of one specific example of one that does believe in the metaphysical. But I mean, it really does come down often to a rejection of human nature and humanity in general. And a lot of these people are, you know, it's often tied in with antinatalism. It's always tied in with being pro-abortion. Not to get into that, but like to my perception, they are very, very anti-human, and anti-human nature. And it is something that, it's just clearly my values are very much not aligned with theirs. And I accept that. I accept their differences as an American. You know, maybe I'm getting to the point where I'm accepting it a little bit less, but I have been accepting of them. Well, and I don't get it in return.
They have things, they have sacraments. So like, I think one of the earliest sacraments was global warming, mm-hmm. you know, Earth Day back in 1970. Yeah.
Sacred truths.
Yeah. Anti-racism before that, but really brought to the fore more. Abortion is another sacrament. If you don't partake in all of these, you must promote them. And, you know, then you have the newest sacrament, which is transgenderism. Mm-hmm. And if you deny transgenderism, even if you're seemingly, you know, it's like sometimes I hear people on the right, like they're like they're praising TERFs. Yeah. Trans-exclusionary radical feminists. And I'm like, you know what the RF means, right? What do you have in common with this person other than, I mean, they're just one step away from this other, you know, phenomena.
Right.
And you're praising them because they're calling out trans, even though they're still radical feminists. Okay.
Yeah. 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 I've noticed that as well. And there is an element of like, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But at a certain point, like, and I think there's been somewhat of a convergence between TERFs and some right wing circles. But it's very likely that it's just of convenience, essentially. But in maybe it's just the TERFs that I've seen. But there seems to be other views that they have, which have, you know, maybe because of the moving of the Overton window, but that a lot of their views have become right wing in a certain way. It's interesting. It definitely is something that's not thought of as much. Well, I also think TERF has kind of become a stand-in just for anybody that's transphobic. So
yeah,
maybe so, I'm a TERF.
So how can you have a religion if you don't have a church that you go to?
Yeah. So let me just read the definition of here. And they do have churches. They have plenty of churches. And let's talk about why. But so here's the definition we're using. And there's many different definitions, even in anthropology, but in other other cultures, other languages, other fields of study. But in anthropology, which is what I do, especially my podcast, Illegitimate Scholar, this is a definition from anthropology. And there's others, but this is one that I chose for this. So a social institution. So that means that it's created. It's not innate. It is something that's created. Characterized by sacred stories, symbols, and symbolism, the proposed existence of immeasurable beings, powers, states, places, and qualities, rituals and means of addressing the supernatural, specific practitioners, and change. And that would be like change over time. So in this definition, a number of things, I can start with what I would call a church if you'd like, which is that essentially the church ends up being almost the university. And there's other examples of this, but I think that a university is a good example of this because the things that are being taught there, and it's taken on a perception in the society as a place of being a rite of passage, as, you know, moving into the modern world. And a lot of the classes which are required, I mean, in a lot of these colleges now, they're requiring courses at the beginning that are specifically anti-racist. They're also, they require courses in specific fields like humanities that are just, you know, this stuff is built into the field, especially in education. And they produce specific practitioners, being the professors, who are hand selected by institutions, not for any other trait, but by the institutions for political purposes, and in, especially today. So that would be church, but there's plenty of other things where these other examples, if you want me to get into them, about why it's a religion and how they can practice without having a church.
Well, yeah, I immediately thought when you said that the university is the church, then it seems like they've been on a crusade to get to take over the down to the kindergartens and even younger. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously, but, and it's, you know, spreading scripture is essentially what it is, and it's in all these books produced by these people who are thought to have, you know, special power. Essentially, is what it comes down to.
Yeah. I mean, well, every movement's going to have that, where it's like your speakers that, you know, that make the most sense, that everybody wants to hear from, the most popular people.
So, yes, and that is what I'm talking about. But that just reminded me of a second part of this, is that there's also so there's this idea in animism, and animism is essentially like hunter gatherer religion in animism. And it expands past hunter gatherer. But this is found every continent in the world in different human groups, is that they believe that every single living thing, as well as non-living thing, is imbued with power. This is where the word mana comes from Polynesian culture. Mana is in all things. It's called Manitou in the Eastern Algonquin Native Americans, where I'm from in New England. And there's a word for it in the Viking languages. And this is completely common.
Mana's in the Bible.
Yeah, mana, I think. Yes, mana. Absolutely. And that's a holdover from development from these earlier religions. But yes, this is a concept. And so individual orders for their skill would absolutely in the past be selected. But what I think you see is that today, with, you know, anti-racism, is that people that are perceived as victims are also perceived as having innately more of this spiritual energy. You know, just based on who they are considered to have higher mana. And in a lot of earlier societies, what you would see is people with specific types of externalities, maybe somebody that has a physical deformity, or somebody that has what we would diagnose today as schizophrenia, they would have a specific spiritual purpose in those societies. So that's the standard that you would see across different continents in the past. It's just applied a little bit differently today.
So talk a little bit more about the priests and the priest class, and I guess the warrior too, because there definitely are, you know, there definitely are like warrior monks amongst these groups.
Yeah. Are you referring to Antifa essentially?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they're So any sort of, what would be a priest? And priest is actually a term that's used specifically in anthropology to refer them to more than just those that would call themselves priests. But priests would be people that officially practice this. So a priest would be something like Ibram X. Kendi, definitely. Any sort of professors would probably be lower grade. I mean, Ibram X. Kendi would come out more like a bishop, essentially, because he's got people below him to make a comparison religiously. And then there's lower practitioners, right? There's ones that are considered practicing that maybe they would be called preaching in a different term, of things like teachers and enforcers in the form of social workers and things like that, and everything in all these other places in society. But when you look at something like Antifa, or even just marching in general, violent or nonviolent, what you see is there's a term called rites of intensification. I don't know if you remember this from my episode, but rites of intensification, and I'll just read this little definition here. It's a ritual that reinforces the value. So you're going out and showing your value. So a riot or a protest is perfect for this, because it's essentially virtue signaling. You go out, it's a community event. You know, people all get together, they all think the same thing, and they're showing how great they are. They'll put the pictures on social media to show their virtue, show their religion, show how committed they are to these ideals. And an example of that in more traditional religions, using an example from Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest, you would have a totem pole ceremony, which over time, these totems, you would have a large log or tree, basically like a straight tree with the bark cut off. And over time, they would have yearly or several years a ceremony when each time they did it, they carved a new totem in the totem pole, and it would go up and up and up and tell a story. And that is a rite of intensification. That's a ritual that is intensifying the commitment to everything, to commitment to the ideals of that culture. And that's led by community leaders, religious leaders, led by people with specific spiritual meaning. You know, in this case, it's Black people, it's LGBTQIA plus people, it's all those sorts of things.
It's no secret that being sick, frail, and weak makes you easier to antagonize and manipulate. Even worse, it forces you to rely upon a system that seeks to keep you that way. It's long past time to start taking your health and fitness seriously. If not for yourself, at minimum for the people that rely upon you. This is the exact purpose of Axios Fitness Coaching, a one-stop shop for exercise programs, diet and lifestyle consultations, and accountability as needed for whatever your demands are. Personally, I can tell you from my first consultation, I'm down 7 pounds and I'm working out at least every other day. Go to freemanbeyondthewall.com/Axios and click the link to find a program, join a training community, or simply set up an intro call with a coach to see how you can start investing your health for the long term. Thank you. Well, it's interesting that if you call it a religion, and you call it a religion in the United States, I mean, I don't, if you called it that, they immediately are like, no, it's not a religion. It'd be interesting if they try to get it to be a religion, considering they would have First Amendment, they'd have First Amendment protections. And then, you know, most people who believe in the First Amendment or whatever bullshit liberalism this country was founded upon are like, well, you know, live and let live, you know, just let them be over there. I believe that's one of the reasons why you don't see more people speaking out about this in public, is because I think they may instinctively understand that it is a religion and they don't want to insult somebody else's religion. Why else would you not?
Right. So, I mean, it really is that I would have more of these conversations with people on the other side, but they would immediately think that I'm arguing in bad faith based on how foundational these beliefs are to them. So there's just no point in doing it. And there's no point in even trying to. And there's also the fact that there seems to be some very real incentives against speaking out about it. I mean, there's personal issues that you can have for having opinions that are deemed going against these beliefs. So I should talk about its status as a religion. The reason I talk about it as a religion is really to point out the point that what a religion isn't really as well defined as we would hope it to be. Like, there's nothing innate. It's not an eternal truth that there is a definition of religion. I read a lot of different religious texts, and one of my favorite is written by Lao Tzu about a little bit over 2,000 years ago in China. It's called the Tao Te Ching, if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. And the first line of that is the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. And that, you know, it has very many religious implications, but to me, it also has implications to socially constructed ideas. So when we come out and we say the word religion, it's immediately socially constructed, in the sense that when you say religion, people have a certain perception of what that religion is and what religion means and what the definition of a religion is and what it looks like. And when the definition of religion was created, and this was an academic venture that started only a few hundred years ago, when this definition was created in modern English, it was based on, you know, it's rooted in what Abrahamic religions are. And they tried to get a definition that is very broad, but what inevitably ends up happening is that people's beliefs in Christianity, Judaism, these Abrahamic religions that are the root, they affect what that perception is. So what you end up having is in China, even though more than 30% of people visit a shrine weekly, only 10% of Chinese people identify themselves as religious. And you know, it's that type of thing where clearly they are religious. They're obviously religious, but there's a disconnect between what a religion is and what it's not. And essentially my point is that, you know, this is the realm of man, naming things, defining things. And these things are not, they're not as set in stone. And ultimately, going a step back, things like anthropology, while they're called science, they're not science. They're just not. Anthropology, I love anthropology. It's argument. It should be considered a humanities subject. All of it should be considered argument. It should not be considered to the point of absolute truth where, you know, it's not chemistry. It's not biology.
My friend Charles Haywood, someone I respect very much, says he doesn't consider it a religion because they're not willing to die for it. They're not willing to martyr themselves for it.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But they are willing to cut off body parts, alter, you know, change their sexes, adopt the most insane things, like, you know, they, them. Yeah, if you try and watch, I've tried to watch TV shows recently, and like, they're using those kind of pronouns. So
yeah,
they're where, you know, where Christians get crap for believing that Christ rose from the dead, that he ascended to heaven, that the Eucharist is the transubstantiation, things like that, is insane. Well, I mean, there are people walking around who are saying that, you know, women are men, and that, you know, men can menstruate and get pregnant. And I mean, I think that's probably one of the easiest ways to figure out that it's a religion. They're making absurd claims that have to be taken on faith.
Right. Exactly. And that's like, that Ibram X. Kendi quote where he says, I should get the exact quote here. Yeah. Okay. So here's another one, but I want to read this one as well. There is no, I should stop saying Henry Rogers. I'm going to call him Henry Rogers. It sounds like a pirate name. It's a shame he's what he is. There is no such thing as a non-racist or race neutral policy. Every policy in every institution, in every community, in every nation is producing or sustaining either racial inequity or equity between racial groups. And I mean, like, it, to me, I read that and I just immediately think that it's almost like it's midichlorians. Like, racism is midichlorians. Like, is the racism in the room with you right now?
If it's a proper government, I would agree. If it's a proper government, with a high culture, I would agree, because the best way to design a government would be to, for the benefit of the people, and you would have to know the people, and it would have to be, and even an economy, the best way to have an economy is, and the laws surrounding it and everything is directed towards the people who live there. And it would have to be a small group, and it would have to be a monocultural group. So you can, if countries in Africa, which are just literal shitholes where they're still living in shit, just decided, well, how do we design something that benefits these people? That's fine. If the United States designed a government that was like, okay, how do you, or if the founders did it where they were like, how do we design a government that's perfect for the people we have here now? Maybe they did that. Who knows? But as soon as you... So if you design a government that is designed towards your people and the people in that polity, and I don't care if... Yeah, sure. Okay, everyone looks alike. Everyone is of the same race, all of that. That shouldn't be a problem, because if you design it right and you design it to benefit the strengths and to mitigate the weaknesses of the people within that area, yeah, that's racist. That's a really good racist thing. That's, it's racial. And that is the way, that's why when you start importing people into this country who don't know, who aren't a part of the culture, who aren't willing to change to be a part of the culture, you start having the problems that you do. They can't adapt to the way things are here. So you have to start changing the way things are here, and it starts to benefit in a way to benefit them, but then it starts taking away from the native population, and now you're in chaos.
Right.
So he's right. What he's arguing against when saying that every policy everywhere is racist, if those policies were there to benefit the host population and whatever strengths and weaknesses they have, that would be a good thing. And I think that the world would be better. But
right. Yeah. Yeah. And I pretty much fully agree. It's, you know, the way that they check if something is racist is they look at disparities in outcomes, right? Which is just a terrible thing to do, because if you have a society that has standards, and you have specific standards, like you said, based on the native population, or to be more specific, just to not have confusion, like native to the United States would be like the Anglo-Saxon,
right?
Like native to that political entity, which is the founding stock of the country, correct. not indigenous,
right,
to the actual land. So
right.
They, you know, those standards and the government that's created, those come from custom and tradition over time, and they're created, and that those are culturally informed, even if there isn't considered to be an element of nature, which I do think that people will immediately just push nature entirely aside and they'll just say nurture. But even if they want to say it's just nurture, it's still just nurture. Because if you have a situation where you want these standards to continue, then that means that it's possible that if another group tries to assimilate, that there's going to be a disproportionate amount of them that either have a positive experience or a negative experience with those standards. And that's when you see things like populations of Asians, Jews, high caste Indians coming to the United States and having disproportionately higher income than the average American and the average white American. But in that case, it's not said, even though it would just be the natural reverse of racism, of the disproportionate negative outcome for those things, but they're not considered like, you know, racially loved by the native whites somehow, even though it is, I'm sorry, I think that was a little wordy, but do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, well, once you have people come in from the outside, and the people who founded the founding stock, the WASP stock, you know, right from the beginning, it's like, hey, you know, live and let live. And, you know, people have freedom to do what they want, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, whatever. Then people can come in and they can subvert, and they can turn not only the government but the economy into something. They can transform it into something that benefits them over the people who are here. You know, it's like you talk to the average, you know, the average Joe, the average Southerner whose family has been here for four centuries, and, you know, Scottish stock, and, you know, you ask them to explain compound interest, they have a kind of an idea what it is, and, you know, but they don't know the intricacies of it and the ins and outs of it. You ask, you know, someone on Wall Street who's wearing a tiny hat, they know exactly what it is, and they know mm-hmm. how to avoid it, which is even more important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when it comes to this whole thing about anti-racism or all things, you know, yeah, if they want to play that game, I mean, I think that like usury and things like that are completely racist against, you know, Christians.
Yeah, or I agree.
Yeah, or anti-Christian. it's a war against Christians, because, you know, even though so many Christians in the United States have bought into it, usury is not allowed. I mean, we had there were debates about that hundreds of years ago.
I know. And honestly, I've just recently, over the past year or two, I've gotten to the point where essentially, you know, a culture, the institutions that we have, they come from our culture. And there's a reason usury was explicitly stopped for thousands of years intentionally, because they understood the results of the destabilizing effects of things like this. I mean, there's examples of Queen Elizabeth I cutting off a possible new technology explicitly for the purpose. And this was a technology, nothing like usury. I mean, usury is an insane technology, and I'm using technology in the form of an idea technology. When put into practice, it is a technology, but it just a simple machine that was being created that was brought to the attention of Elizabeth I, and her explicit remark was that, like, no, this could possibly destabilize the economy of the area, so we're not going to use it. And it was just some sort of advancement in farming, and that used to be the intention. But what we have now is a culture that it doesn't evaluate things like that. It doesn't there isn't thought given to, or at least enough pragmatic thought given to, how a technology like social media is going to fit into our incentive structure and the culture that we have today. Whereas you see a country like China and a technology like phones, like games, video games, and like TikTok, I mean, they change it to fit within their culture. And that's not something that we do anymore. It's just all towards the bottom line, 3-month economic cycle, and having that low kind of time preference, that preference for, and this comes from the top down, but I truly think it affects all aspects of life. This economy that exists on this 3-month cycle of quarterly earnings, you know, that falls all the way down. And what you end up with is a culture that doesn't care about what happens in 20 years, much less 200 years. Whereas, you know, the Chinese culture, which is the most pervasive culture in world history that that has retained itself. They were contemporaries of Alexander as well as of the Romans, the Byzantines, Constantine, as well as, you know, the British Empire. You know, everyone else is gone, but they're around, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah, they're insular. Yeah, they're insular, and they're not nomadic. They stay in one place.
Right. Yeah. Nomadism is, I mean, nomadic cultures, they conquered a lot, but they were essentially just cleansing forces that would conquer a lot and then settle in and assimilate. But the Han culture is the opposite. It retains itself even throughout hundreds of years of foreign dynastic rule. And I mean, a perfect example of China is that 500 years ago, on the concept of technology, I mean, they had the greatest navy in the world, and they burned it. They burned it to the ground because 500 years ago, they saw everything they needed to see.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, and we keep going to our own detriment.
Yeah, exactly.
We just keep pushing it. And the whole woke thing doesn't help, because that it's the idea of progress, but it's not. I don't really know what I believe of technological progress anymore. I mean, I don't know how much further we're going to go, but I think it's pretty scary now. I'm not saying that I want to go back to, you know, the Bronze Age, but a real good examination of where we're at would be something. I think Kaczynski tried to give us a good examination of where we were headed, and, you know, we didn't listen. But the whole idea with this wokeism is the most dangerous part of wokeism, I think, is the fact that if they believe that they can perfect man, if they can make man sinless, like in some kind of Wesleyan fever dream, then eventually it's going to this is going to involve pharmaceuticals.
Right.
And it's going to be forced. And, you know, Paul Gottfried has talked about that with the therapeutic state, where it's going to it very well can get to the point where it's just like, OK, we cannot believe that you still believe this. We cannot believe that you still are proud of what your ancestors did. We cannot believe that you still want to live on your ancestral land, you know, where you want to be buried in the same cemetery that your ancestors were buried in. We have to do something to stop this. And if that means that we have to inject, hold you down, and put chemicals in your body to try to change your mind in some kind of chemical, you know, some kind of chemical lobotomy, that's where it's going to come to.
Yeah. And I think that there are small instances of essentially this, and you'll see it in things like, I mean, going into Kanye West. And I don't know how much you've heard about what he said, but he did talk about how they were right. Great. I'm glad you did. You know, as a lot of the stuff he was saying was really scaring me, that he was in there. You know, they were trying to medically force drugs on him. And, you know, based on their perception, based on, you know, and they say he has bipolar disorder, but that, again, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. That is a, you know, that's a social construction. That's an idea that they have of him, and an idea that they've compiled of his symptoms, a socially created way, where they've decided that his way of acting fits into this mold, and then he has to have this pill. And I feel like that is going to continue to be applied to more and more things. And as it's become normalized in our society to the point where vaccine mandates were essentially just allowed, that what you're saying is true.
Not only were they allowed, but people championed them. People lined up for them.
Yeah. And people I used to respect.
Yeah. And people, like I said, people championed them, and not only championed them, treated you like you were a heretic if you spoke out, if you questioned it.
Exactly. A heretic. That's
and tell me some, point out to me somebody who has succumbed to the woke religion who was as anti-vax as I was. And I probably wasn't as anti-vax as some people I know were running on their podcasts, and just like, it was like every episode they were talking about that. I mean, I talked about it a lot, and I said, there's no way I'm going to get this thing. And I don't think you should either. If you're, you know, get it if you want. I don't think you should get it, but get it if you want. I'm not going to tell people want to make stupid decisions. They can make stupid decisions. But yeah, I mean, I was called all sorts of things. And I mean, the half the reason my YouTube is demonetized is because of it.
Right. Yeah. And that sort of monetary punishment being acceptable and being seen as something that is okay to do, even though we're in this situation with these giant monopolistic companies, and we're in a situation where there's been clear evidence of influence from intelligence communities and other government officials. But like, people just don't seem to care. And that's a problem.
Yeah,
it's a real problem.
And it also points to this being a religion. I mean,
right.
There were a lot of people who weren't, you know, who wouldn't consider to be a part of the woke church, who were pro vaccine and pro Ukraine and, you know, all the Slava Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But I mean, really, find me somebody in the woke religion who's not Slava Ukraine and who isn't like 100% vaxxed and who doesn't wear a mask. I mean, these people wear masks when they don't announce a new variant, just so that they can. It's basically, it's like wearing a cross.
Mm-hmm.
They're,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think that Ted Kaczynski would call it over socialization, essentially, because it's tied right into this concentration on higher institutions of higher education, as well as, you know, large scale NGOs knowing best. You know, these are the types of people who are going to listen to what the ADL says, like it's scripture, because to them it is. And what the top professors say, and what the top professor is essentially who's held up by the universities. And you see that with somebody like Dr. Peter McCullough, who was, you know, his accolades were like no other in the traditional institutions, but because he was disavowed at this particular time by the other by the institutions themselves, it didn't matter what his accolades were, because, you know, to anybody that I interacted with who's a liberal in New England, which is most of them, is that, you know, he's a kook, he's a quack, he's whatever. It doesn't matter that he got published thousands of times and you know, thousands of citations in the New England Journal of Medicine, which everybody knows is the premier one, even by their own standards, not by my standards, but by their standards.
Here's something we can, a subject we can end with. There are religions that have staying power that are around forever. Christianity, it seems, Islam, Judaism, real paganism, not,
neo-paganism.
Yeah. Is this that? Or is it like, you know, the Heaven's Gate cults kind of thing where it's just eventually going to fizzle out and maybe a bunch of them will end up all living in the same house and waiting for a spaceship to show up?
So I view it a lot like a state religion, to be honest, a state of religion of the aristocracy, because I see these beliefs tied a lot into people, you know, this information comes top down from Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, all these Ivy League schools, these top institutions. But what I also see in the biggest comparison, I think I would call to this, and I would also call a lot of iterations of communism. There's the obvious example of Juche, which is the state religion of North Korea. But even the other ones, because they deny an official religion, this is an idea that you know, Russell Brand has a great quote about this that I start the episode out with, that episode 39 on Illegitimate Scholar about wokeism being religion. It's Russell Brand saying the human being is one that worships. And if you do not choose what to worship, then what you worship will be chosen for you. And I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. But that's essentially what it is. And it's the foundational beliefs. Those foundational beliefs that are taught in a way, and they exist in a way that it promotes something that really reminds me of the Cultural Revolutions in China. It's not a religion in the traditional sense, whereas Islam, you know, traditional Islam, Orthodox in Orthodox Christianity and Catholic Christianity, not Protestantism, maybe some of them, but mostly no. But Orthodox and Catholic.
Liturgical Christianity. Right.
Yes, exactly. It's a better term. In Islam and Orthodox Judaism and a few other sects of Judaism, they have this element of timelessness and of you know, the turning wheel, which you see in so many different cultures and different names for it. Whereas a religion like this or a belief system like this is rooted on constant upheaval and goals of the religion that are unreachable. And these goals being the eradication of racism worldwide, the eradication of these forces. You have something like the Cultural Revolution where in China every 5 years there's this giant, you know, take to the streets and decentralized. It's always decentralized in these cases of things like this, and destroy the old things, create new things, you know, solve these problems. But really the things that they do, like you said at the beginning, they don't really address the problems. They just continue to have institutions and people that are perceived to be attacking the problem. And it's something that keeps itself going, not by being timeless, but keeps itself going by continuing to just throw embers on this fire, to throw more fuel on the fire. That's what I perceive it as. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But what's funny about that is, Jefferson called for like a revolution every generation. And basically what you just described is what this country has become, is just one ongoing revolution of, I mean, who knows what it is. And now we've gotten to the point where this is dominating and people have trouble seeing that the reason why this can dominate is because the system has been set up so that temporary revolutions can come in every once in a while and take it over.
right,
and then dominate it. And you know, and I'm sure there are people out there who think that they can take it over and take it over for 1,000 years. But I don't think it's designed that way.
So, right. Yeah. Right. And so the one thing that I have to say about Jefferson saying that is, like, maybe that was set up in a way that, you know, all human constructions must end eventually. But Jefferson didn't say this, but several of the very important founding fathers, and I believe Jefferson being one of them, they did talk about America being a Christian country for Christian people. And so these revolutions that might happen every generation, as long as those revolutions were made with the backbone of this timeless belief system, and as long as those revolutions happened within the spirit of the Constitution, the revolution every generation would simply be, you know, with the changing situation, with the changing geopolitical situation, with the changing of the geopolitical situation and the domestic situation, new laws could be created that would fit the new situation. But those would be created with the backbone of these more timeless ideological ideas like Christianity. And honestly, with the destruction of Christianity, the destruction of the belief systems, and the rising importance of secular institutions, you know, explicitly secular institutions, then the situation will change in a different way. So I think it worked for a while, and no longer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And now it can just really be hijacked by anyone. And, you know, here's the thing is everything's a cycle. There's nothing when it comes to politics, it doesn't seem like there's anything permanent. Thomas was talking on an episode we just recorded, World War One, Volume Episode One, which is going to be releasing tomorrow, the day after we're recording this. You know, people see war as like this thing that that is planned, and all these, you know, maybe it's conspired, but really war comes like the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's to believe, I think at some point, to believe that you're going to institute a government, or the kind of government that you have, that you want, and for it to survive for 1,000 years, I mean, you're just clueless. It just doesn't work that way. Now, of course, you can get invaded from the outside, but you know, it doesn't have to be an army. This country was invaded by immigration. And I'm not even talking about like the last 30 years. I'm talking about immigration in the late 1800s.
Right.
It pretty much put a dagger in what was done here. So, yeah.
And you know, I'm saying this as a, you know, my blood's mostly Celtic. Like I shouldn't be here, basically. And the other element that we didn't get to is, you know, colonialism and people spreading out to other places, like going to India, eventually leads to the reverse of that because of the cultural ties that are created. You know, I think I'd be a lot better off if the English had never gone to Ireland. I'd be there in a roundhouse with like the wood on the grass on the roof, like in a kilt, you know, fighting people with swords or clubs or whatever the hell it was. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Heroic society. That's what I want to be doing. Yeah. But I'm American. What am I supposed to do? I'm American. I'm not Irish. So I'm here. That's it.
Yeah. All right. Well, remind everybody where they can find your work, and we'll leave this open for it. We'll leave it open for another date, and come on and we'll pick something so completely opposite to talk about from this that people will be like, what?
Yeah. Wonderful. It's actually funny because right now I'm doing something completely opposite of this, which is I'm shooting a documentary about Jimmy Buffett fans, parrot heads, which is very different, but it's still in the line of I'm studying their culture. Essentially, they have a great culture. I love it.
Well, what's hilarious is we've pretty much become, I have a documentary filmmaking company too, and we've pretty much become famous for doing a documentary on libertarianism and anarchism, and then a documentary on historic to how the evolution of policing out of England into the United States. And we just started today shooting a documentary about a group of vets who started motorcycle club to help vets with PTSD by going on rides.
Oh, that's awesome. I heard about them. Yeah. I'm a vet myself. I did say that. I know neither of us are really explicitly libertarian anymore. Is that correct to say?
Yeah. I think I could have a libertarian society if I had like 15 people who thought like me and
yeah. I think I could do a communist society even if it had people that thought like me. I could do any type. Yeah, that's kind of where it comes down to.
Yeah.
But on that note, so Illegitimate Scholar, that's on YouTube, that's on all different podcasting platforms. Ill_scholar on Twitter. I post a lot of aesthetic stuff. I've been on an architecture kick recently, some memes, bunch of other stuff. And I do a live show every Thursday night, sometimes with guests, at 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. California time, sometimes with guests, often alone with current events. Regular shows are once weekly, usually on anthropological topics, basically like the same stuff I talked about today. And 5 till midnight, name's going to be changing, but Monday night, conglomerate with the guys from Biting the Bullet, Adam Nutter, and Kyle Matovchik. We do that every week, Monday night at 8 p.m. It's a lot of fun. It's nothing like anything else I do.
I've been on all those guys' shows.
I know you have. Yeah. No, I was talking to them and I was talking about it. I didn't name drop them when I just wanted to like reach out to you on my own merit, but I know that you know all of them.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it, Sam. Till the next time. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Pete.